Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, you might want to jump on that Here We Still Stand regional conference in Bentonville. That thing's filling up. Going to sell out. So if you want to go, make sure you grab a ticket, hang out with Chad and I and a whole bunch of other people in Bentonville, Arkansas, April 16th and 17th. Definitely, if you're able, we'd love to see you there. It's going to be a good time. Chad, we are going to wrap up the book of 1 Samuel. Now, we've said goodbye to the person who the book is named after, Samuel, a few chapters back. Today, we are going to say goodbye to another main figure in this book who is going to, as Samuel said, join him.
Yeah, I think we're, I don't know, I can't speak for everybody, but I'm kind of ready for Saul to be out of the picture, only because it's like sometimes when you're watching a series on Netflix or whatever, and you know something's coming, but it's like, okay, it doesn't happen in the next episode or the next episode or the next episode, but you still know it's coming. It's like when it finally happens, you're like, okay, I'm glad we're finally here. It's kind of like that with Saul. I mean, we'll talk more as we work our way through the chapter about his life and some of the things we've learned, or maybe learned afresh, or change our perspective on with regard to him. But we've known that this time is coming, that his day is coming for quite a while.
Yeah, I think for a guy like Saul too, there's certain people that are tormented enough, plagued enough, that if you have a word from Samuel that you can go, that you're going to go be with him, I think in Saul's case, this is a better place for him to be.
Yeah,
you don't look at Saul's life as it is at this point, and think that this is something that is good and full of joy, and that he's living life with the joy of life being a gift. Dude is intensely tormented by the pressures of being a king, his own madness, all kinds of things. So when Saul dies, you don't really feel as much of, like, it's a tragedy, but that perhaps it's that he is better off. This is not the saddest of things. Now, Jonathan, on the other hand, it is not that way. I mean, no, I'm giving away stuff, but we're going to get there. But when you look at the death, deaths of Saul and Jonathan, you are sort of relieved for Saul, but you're grieved for Jonathan.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the case of Saul, it has, as you say, it's been a downward spiral for quite some time. And in the biblical narrative, had Saul lived on, things would have only have gotten worse. Mm-hmm. So you can see how he goes from having suspicions to jealousy to these fits of rage to pursuing David to, I mean, all the way to our last encounter with him is when he stooped so low as to go and visit a necromancer, a medium. So I mean, you can't get much lower than where he's gone. So it's good. It's good that chapter 31 happens, and that not just that, so that he can reach his end, but also so that we can make the transition into what will be the next phase of Israel's history, where we see David's gradual, it's not immediate. It's not like we're going to turn the page and all of a sudden all Israel gathers around David, cheering him and proclaiming him to be a king. There's still going to be several years coming up where David continues to struggle because of Saul's son. We'll get to that, but it is going to be a transitional period for us as we focus more and more on David's rise to power. But anyway, let's look at this relatively short chapter. It's only 13 verses, and see what actually happens at Saul's end. So to bring kind of everybody up to speed to where what we know, when Saul consulted the medium, he had seen the forces of the Philistines gathering. And so I talked a couple episodes before about how some of this is out of sequence. You know, we have him with the medium, then we have David doing this, then we're kind of back to Saul, back to David. So David right now is as far away as possible from the scenes that are about to transpire, which I think is the narrative was set up that way. Like So remember, David was going to go and fight with the Philistines against the Israelites, and the Philistine leaders were like, no, no, get that guy out of here. So David had to go back south with his men. They get back there. Their town has been raided, pillaged, so they have to chase those guys down farther south. So David has been moving south, south, south. So he's as far away as possible from Saul when Saul dies. And of course, he's not going to know. It's not like he can check the internet the next day and get the news. He's not going to know for quite a while until somebody shows up to tell him what happened to Saul. So for all David knows, Saul has been successful in his campaign against the Philistines because he's so far separated from him. Saul, on the other hand, is way up north where he's about to face this great Philistine army that's gathered together for this massive offensive against Israel. So that's the context. So verse 1 says, now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Now, anytime you start out like that, you know this is not going to be good for the Israelites. The Philistines, we don't know how the numbers compared, but the Philistines had gathered all their forces, so a sizable number were going against the Israelites.
Yeah, this kind of gives you the impression that this battle wasn't one of those battles where it was kind of close for a little while, and the tide turned, and gradually the Israelites started to be overwhelmed. This sounds like they came out to fight, and this was a rout from the jump.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, we've been talking about, I'm listening to the Hardcore History podcast right now, and while when they describe some of the battles, you know, maybe it's the Persian against the Greeks or whatever it might be, there comes a point in many of these battles where either because of fear or overwhelming odds or whatever it might be, the overwhelmed forces realize they have only one choice, and that is to retreat.
Yep.
And usually what happens when that transpires is you have a massive slaughter that takes place because they can get you in the back, they can chase you down. And so I suspect that's what was going on here in verse 1. That's why the Israelites fell slain on Mount Gilboa. But it wasn't just kind of the random Israelites. Verse 2 says that the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons. And then we have the verse that you alluded to earlier, Dan. The Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. So this is a terrible day for Israel. I mean, not only are they about to lose their king, as we'll see in the next few verses, but they've lost Jonathan, who is, as we've talked about before, one of the best men that we've encountered, not just in 1 Samuel, but really in the entire Old Testament. It's really, really difficult to find a character who's has more integrity, more faithfulness, more just kind of those qualities that are often lauded in the scriptures. They're held up as great qualities for a person to have. And so it's very difficult not to like Jonathan and to admire him. And yet, on this day, he, along with two of his brothers, are struck down by the Philistines. Verse 3, to continue, says the battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. So who knows what, I mean, we kind of wish we had more details about what was happening here and the sequence of events. Were Saul's sons killed around him? Were they like a fighting unit together, or what happened? We're just not told. But we are told that at least the archers from the Philistines were able to get close enough to where they could wound Saul. Not kill him, but wound him. Saul, verse 4, Saul realizes that it's over. I mean, he knows that there's no recuperating from the arrow wounds. So he turns to his armor bearer, and he says to him, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor bearer wouldn't do it. It says because he feared greatly. Though we're not sure, I mean, what was he afraid of? Was he just kind of, maybe just panicked? in the battle, which, you know, would not be uncommon whatsoever for someone just to kind of completely lose their cool. He's too scared to do anything. He's almost just kind of traumatized into unaction. Maybe that's why. Maybe it was because he feared God, and because of that, he wouldn't do this to the king. Or maybe he was like David. You know, David had many opportunities to thrust Saul through as well. Two in particular, in the cave, and then when Saul was asleep with a spear at his head. But in both those occasions, David, because of his fear of God and his fidelity to the king, would not thrust Saul through. So whatever the reason, the armor bearer is not going to do what Saul asked him to do.
Yeah, and it could be, and I'm drawing this from what happens next, but it could be this sort of thing. This is his armor bearer, so this is someone who, this is not just anybody. This is not some random soldier that he says this to. This is somebody who is with Saul a lot. You would assume that he's close with Saul. They probably have a relationship, and this is just something that it seems that he just can't do. And you could put yourself in that situation. I mean, I'm sure if you were with someone that you knew well and they were wounded and they said, you know, you need to go ahead and put me out of my misery so I don't get captured, this might be a very difficult thing for you to do. Not to mention if that person is the king. I mean, you can imagine if you were like the president's security and he's wounded and he says, shoot me. You might be like, I feel like that could come back on me in a bad way, potentially.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So, or maybe you have a fondness for him and you're like, I just can't do that. And we'll see that the armor bearer is not just unwilling to do it. He doesn't do it, but he also won't leave.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like after Saul does what he does, as we'll get to in a second. It's not like he runs from the battle. No, he is, as we shall see, he's fiercely devoted to Saul. He won't leave him there. So whatever the reason is for his refusal, he does refuse to do this. So Saul's left, basically, he's down to his last option. Saul's made a lot of choices in his lifetime, and a lot of them were bad choices. Some of them were good, but he's down to one last choice. And this choice is either to be there, wounded, let the Philistines come up, probably do some pretty horrific, torturous things to him, not to mention just the whole humiliation that goes along with this. And this was if you're familiar with ancient warfare, this was not unusual. We've seen evidence in the Bible itself as to what was done to the leaders of your enemies when they were captured. And it was not something you wanted to be done to you. So Saul chooses instead to take his own life. And that's the way that verse 4 ends. So Saul took his sword and he fell on it. And then to get back to what we were hinting at about the armor bearer, verse 5 says that when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died with his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men on that day together. And you almost have to, that sixth verse, you just kind of have to like read it very slowly.
Yeah.
It is one of those extremely weighty verses in this story. Then Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men on the same day together. I mean, I'll sometimes be in church and I'll be listening to whoever's reading the scriptures and I almost want to say, hey, wait, slow down a little bit. You know, like pause. Because this is one of those things where you just can't rush past it. You got to take in everything that's being communicated in these few verses. You've got in these few words, the king's dead. And his successors, at least some of his potential successors, are also dead. His sons are dead. Armor bearer is dead. And it adds all his men on that day together. And of course, you know, we don't know exactly how many soldiers died, but I'm guessing that this was a massive slaughter. Because we'll see in the rest of the chapter, because they didn't even get the king's body. you know, they left it on the battlefield. It was there the next day. And if you have any guys who are surviving, and if they're able to get to the king's body, of course they're going to carry that off the battlefield. Nobody was there, or everybody ran, and so even the king's body was just left there out in the open.
Yeah, and this "together" phrase, which is, you know, they all died on that day together, makes you think that this was in one area. This wasn't happening like a battle over here and a battle over there, and that this was one isolated battle that was enormous, probably, and they got routed. And just sort of the way that Saul reacts, and I mean, we don't know this obviously, but if he is wounded and he does know, you know, that all three of his sons have died, I mean, you could see why he would be done.
Yeah. Yeah, you could definitely see where, I mean, any hope he has of the future is just been extinguished by everything that he's experienced.
You have to wonder, too, if, you know, are Samuel's words ringing in his head? I mean, once your sons die and he's, Samuel told you that you and your sons will be with him, Saul saying, you know what, okay. There's sort of an acceptance of what Samuel has said, that this is, okay, this is going to happen.
Yeah, and I don't know how those words from Samuel would not have been stuck in Saul's mind. Because he knew Samuel was a prophet of the Lord. That's why he asked the medium to call him up. So, I mean, he does trust the word to the prophet. And so it would have been, I think, impossible for him not to go into this battle knowing that it was going to be the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also think that, I mean, that we don't know who this armor bearer is, but I will say that I don't think it was cowardice that made him refuse to do what Saul says. It just seems that this is something he was unwilling to do to his king. And once this was done, he was also unwilling to walk away at any point.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if maybe there wasn't an ongoing relationship between this armor bearer and Saul. Like, they had been together in many battles, you know, super, super close. I mean, you think back to who was the first armor bearer we heard about for Saul. It was David, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were, at least for a time, very close, because we're told that Saul loved David. I mean, when he first meet the two of them together, when David is the one who comes to play the harp or the lyre for Saul, yeah, well, Saul loved him. So there was a time when they were extremely close, and so possibly this was the case with this armor bearer too. Okay, let's move on. This is verse 7. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, with those who were beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned the cities and fled. Then the Philistines came and lived in them. Of course, this is kind of a telescoping forward. It wasn't like all this happened really fast, but this is the Bible's way of telling us about the implications of this defeat. Here's what happened. It was so bad that these guys who were living here and there, when they realized that Saul was defeated, they just took off because they knew the Philistines were coming. And as a result, the Philistines were able to recapture these cities and to make them Philistine cities, which is, when you look at this outside of this particular chapter in the big picture of what's been going on, this is a huge setback for the Israelites. This is sort of an unconquest of the Holy Land. The whole purpose of them going into the Promised Land was to drive out the inhabitants and to take their cities and live in their cities. Well, now we had the exact opposite happening. The Israelite leader is killed, the Israelites flee, and the very people that they were supposed to be driving out now come and take possession of these Israelite cities. So it's very much of kind of a reversal of Joshua. And I think the reason this is set up this way is because this is the Bible's way of kind of bringing everything to a head, placing Israel into a very into a situation that's completely contrary to what God willed for them, to put them in these dire straits so that when David comes to power, then we'll see how God was able to work through him and bring Israel back to where he desired them to be. Okay, verse 8, what happens the next day? Next day, the Philistines, they came to strip the slain. So, this was pretty common in these battles as well for either the Philistines or for even, you know, other people. Like, as we'll find out in the opening chapter of 2 Samuel, there was an Amalekite hanging around after the battle too, and he was looking around for stuff he could take off the dead people, and he'll find Saul. But we'll save that for the next time. Anyway, they're checking out the slain, probably taking away whatever they can find from them if they want, and they find Saul and his three sons fallen down on Mount Gilboa. So we're not even, at least I'm not even sure, if the Philistines knew that Saul was dead until this moment. Yeah. You know, they knew, obviously, that they had won the victory, that they had won the battle, and that they were able to drive the Israelites away. You know, that was obvious. But did they know that they'd actually been successful in killing the leader of the Israelites? I'm thinking not, because the way this is told makes it almost sound as if this is a lucky find for them. Like, oh my gosh, look, we were able to kill the king as well as his sons. So what do? Well, they cut off his head. It's verse 9. They cut off Saul's head. They stripped off his weapons, and they sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry, now this is an interesting phrase, to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people.
Well, this is a different kind of gospel here.
It is, yeah. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So in Hebrew, when you carry good news, or when you carry news, especially of a battle, it's the verb is basar. And that is really the Hebrew equivalent of the Greek word for evangelize. So when you evangelize, on its just kind of a generic meaning, you're telling someone about good news. Well, you can do the same thing in Hebrew. You can tell someone about good news or news. And when you do that, when you evangelize in that way, you basar, which is the verb that's used here for them carrying this good news to the house of their idols and to the people. So they're carrying back the gospel, the Philistine gospel, of Saul's, not just his defeat, but his death. And keep in mind that this is not just kind of a military victory for the Philistines. This is a theological victory for them. So strategically, it's great because the leader of their enemy is dead. But also theologically, it's great for the Philistines because this means that their God, to them, this means that their God is better.
Yeah,
their God won.
So they're going to the house of their idols and informing their gods that they have prevailed and killed Saul, because, you know, these particular gods apparently don't know that.
Yeah.
Says something about your God.
Yeah. Yeah, one of those ironies, right? You got to let your God know what happened on the day of battle.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, that's a tell.
Yeah. Yeah, omniscience must not be a quality, an attribute of the Philistine gods.
I guess not. Yeah, they're like, hey, good news, God.
Yeah, guess what? We won.
Preaching the false gospel to your God is a weird thing.
Yeah. And they're not, of course, they've debased the body of Saul. They've cut off his head, stripped off his armor, but they're not done yet. This kind of goes on to describe the rest of what the Philistines did as they were letting everybody know how victorious they were. They put his weapons, that is the weapons of Saul, in the temple of Ashtaroth. That's very similar to what we heard earlier in 1 Samuel, where they put the Ark of the Covenant in the temple of the god Dagon. So now they're taking the armor of the servant of Yahweh. Of course, this isn't the Ark of the Covenant, but it is connected at least to the worship of the Israelites, and they put that in the temple of Ashtaroth, which is a female goddess, and they fasten his body to the wall of Beth Shan. So they're just going to expose his body and, of course, let it be carrion for whatever birds happen to come along. This is a further way of humiliating the Israelites. Now we have the closing verses, last three verses. I mean, I don't want to say it's like a very positive and like a highly positive shift, because this whole chapter is, of course, not the best of news. But this does go to show that even in the recording of the death of Saul, we have evidence that for all his faults, there was something about Saul that was also great, at least early on. You remember when we first met him, after he's anointed as king, his first military campaign was to go and rescue an Israelite city. What had happened was the Ammonites came along and they surrounded the city, and it was obvious that the Israelites couldn't get away. And they said, I'll tell you what, we'll let you live if you bring all your males out, and we're going to gouge out one of their eyes, and then we'll let you live. But the inhabitants of the city said, give us 3 days. So they took these 3 days to go throughout Israel and to see if someone would come and deliver them. Lo and behold, Saul was the man. So Saul gathers an army, and he goes to this city. And this city is the city of Jabesh-Gilead. And he is able to rescue the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead.
Yeah.
Well, these people didn't forget that.
Certainly, when you have the Philistines doing this sort of thing with the body of Saul, they are interested in Israel knowing about it. Because this is part of the insult. And Israel is not just like, well, we don't care what you do with Saul because, you know, he wasn't that great anyway, and you know, we didn't like him. That's not how this reads at all. I think that this would be a great offense. This is an offensive thing for them to do.
Yeah, I mean, for all Saul's faults, he was still king. And he was. It was not like he had abandoned his responsibilities as king to protect the people.
No. No. So, and yeah, I mean, he died on the battlefield.
Died on the battlefield. Yeah. So the people want to respect his body after death. And so what they do, these people of Jabesh-Gilead, the very people that Saul had rescued back in the day, they hear what the Philistines did. And so the valiant men, they walk all night to this city where Saul's body has been exposed. And not just the body of Saul, but also the bodies of his sons. And they remove these from the wall of Beth-shan, and they bring them back to their city, and they cremate them there. They burn their bodies, and they took their bones and they buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. And that's the way the chapter ends. That's the way the book ends, with the burial of the bones of Saul and of his men. Now, there's a number of things that are worthy of talking about here in connection with not just the death of Saul, but just kind of the way this whole thing came together. One of the things I noticed in this chapter is that, man, there's a lot of connections to other events in 1 Samuel, as well as other earlier books even. I mean, just kind of echoes of these other earlier narratives. And some are positive, and some are negative. In fact, there's a number of them that are negative. I mean, you think, okay, when was the only other time we heard about a body of an Israelite being burned? Well, it was all the way back in the days of Achan in Joshua. And why did that happen to him? Because he violated the laws of Haram, of this complete destruction, which is kind of the same thing that happened to Saul. That's the reason that Samuel told Saul the kingship would be taken away from him, because he didn't fully carry out what the prophet had commanded him against the Amalekites. And then another story that leaps immediately to mind, a little bit more connected to this, and that is back in Judges, you had this false king, Abimelech, and at one point he's wounded because a woman throws a millstone on his head from a tower. And he says to his armor bearer, pierce me through so that no one will be able to say that I was killed by a woman. And in that case, his armor bearer is like ready and willing. He's like, pulls out his sword. Abimelech is done. Now, the opposite is the case here with Saul. Saul's wounded, but not by a woman throwing a millstone, but by the Philistines. And then he says to his armor bearer, pierce me through. His armor bearer says, no, I won't do it. And then, of course, one thing I alluded to earlier is that this kind of is a bookend, if you will, to the beginning of 1 Samuel. At the beginning of 1 Samuel, we have once more a great Philistine victory. They come out against the Israelites. They are able to rout them, and then they capture the Ark of the Covenant. Same thing, similar thing here. They come out against the Israelites. They're victorious, and they're able to kill the son, kill the king and his sons. And instead of taking the Ark of the Covenant back to the home of their God, they take the armor of the king back to the home of their God. So it's interesting the way that the book itself is structured, so that we began with this Philistine victory, which then precipitated the Israelites' request for a king. It was after that big loss where they came to Samuel and said, hey, give us a king. Well, now once more, we have a big loss. But what's going to follow after this is not the people asking for a king, but the rise of really the king that God desires them to have in the person of David.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, this might feel like a weird thing to do for them to burn the body of Saul and Jonathan and Saul's other two sons. I'm trying to put myself in that situation because this is not a typical thing that you would do. I mean, Israel is not are not big cremation people. They bury their dead. However, if I was in this situation and there's this guy and his three sons and they're using their bodies to mock, they're desecrating these bodies. All this is going on, and you go and you take those bodies. I can see the argument where you say, we're going to ensure that even if they were to come here and try to retrieve those bodies again, that this is not going to happen, right? Yeah. And so that makes some sense to me, that that bodies that have been treated this way, that you would say, like, we're not even going to, you know, if the Philistines pursued us, found us, well, they're not going to recapture these bodies and hang them up on walls and let birds eat on them and all this kind of stuff. That's not going to happen. We're gonna eliminate that possibility right here.
Yeah, and they certainly treat them with respect. They, after the bodies are burned, they take these bones and they do bury them.
Yeah,
they bury them under this tamarisk tree at their city. I mean, much like the same thing happened with Jacob and his bones. He was embalmed and he was carried to be buried in Israel's. And then when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they took the bones of Joseph with them in order that they could bury those in the land of Israel. Yeah, you look at this chapter in the kind of the light of the big picture of 1 Samuel, what we've learned so far. It's been fascinating to me, and hopefully it has been to everybody else too. Just you get a little bit different perspective on Saul when you see his entire life. We've mentioned a couple of times that our perspective has changed on Saul. I'm much more sympathetic toward him as a person than I had been before. But you can see how over time, kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly was pretty obvious in him. And I mentioned earlier in this podcast, in this episode, how you have a downward spiral. But it wasn't as if from the very beginning he was a loser, or he was a terrible person, or he was someone who was just looking to be kind of a dictator of Israel. Even eventually to the end, he was. One thing that strikes me about Saul is that he was not like some of the other later kings. He wasn't flirting with Baal and Asherah.
Yeah, right.
He was a Yahweh alone kind of person. The mistake he made, and I think this is one of the greatest takeaways that we can get from his life. One of the things that I return to over and over with regard to him is that what was his downfall was he did not fully carry out. He didn't, as it were. How might we say it? He didn't live exclusively by what God had spoken to him through the prophet Samuel. And he was sincere, I do believe. He was sincere in what he did wrong, but that sincerity in the end really didn't help him out very much.
Yeah.
Samuel had said, when you get to the Amalekites, then you are to carry out the decree of God that they all are dead. And Saul didn't do this. And maybe he had like sincere justification for why he didn't do that. He was going to maybe execute the king later, and he was going to offer the animals a sacrifice. Well, that's okay, but in the end, it's not our sincerity or our good motives or anything like that by which we live. Instead, it's got to be what God has told to us. So this kind of this almost blind acceptance, closing your eyes to everything except what God has said when it comes to matters like this, is one of the great takeaways from the life of Saul.
Yeah, Saul is certainly a guy who, at the end of the day, was not perfectly equipped to be king, but he was not ill-equipped because he was an idolater or a coward. He was neither of these things. He was not an idolater, and, you know, a more cowardly man than Saul might have heard the words of Samuel and said, well, the last place that me and my sons are going to be tomorrow is on the battlefield. Yeah. But this is not the kind of guy that Saul was. You never get the impression that Saul is afraid or that he's a coward or anything like that. And you never get the impression that he is even interested in any other god.
No, which, I mean, if you know the rest of the history of the kings, sets him apart. I mean, relatively speaking, if you look at the rest of the kings of Israel, Saul was one of the top probably five best, which is the crazy thing to say, given what we know about Saul. But at least in regard to being faithful to Yahweh alone, he stands out, because almost all these other kings were flirting with a multiplicity of other gods.
I mean, you're talking about a guy who, even when he can no longer get a hold of God, when God is no longer talking to him, so this would be where most people say, well, maybe there's some other god that I could get involved with that would give me some direction. It doesn't appear as though it ever even enters Saul's mind.
No, he's like, I'm gonna use a medium to call upon the prophet of Yahweh.
Yeah, this is a guy that is desperate to hear from the one God.
Yeah. I mean, it's a reminder too that as I think about his death, there's almost, with Saul, there's almost no other way that he could die, because in this sense, he was a guy, you know, his greatest enemy was always himself, and Saul was on this path of self-destruction for quite some time. So it's almost fitting that I'm not justifying in somehow the way he died, but when you look at the story of Saul, the fact that Saul killed himself, that he died by his own hand, kind of fits with a whole trajectory of what had been happening in his life. I mean, he really was a guy who seemed to be bent on self-destruction because of his actions. And so you can see how this was, just from the narrative perspective, a fitting way for his life to end, as sad as it was. And it for me anyway, I mean, again, one of my takeaways from Saul is that, and you can see that that he really was his greatest foe. And it's a great reminder to me that you know, we can look out and we can see maybe people who are against us or this or that that's opposed to us. But at the end of the day, it's the guy I see in the mirror every morning when I wake up that is the one that is really my greatest enemy. And for that reason, to learn from the life of Saul is to, once more, to trust not in myself or in anything that I can do, but instead of to trust in the God of mercy, who is trustworthy, unlike I am.
Yeah, and that's where we will we'll leave it. That is the book of 1 Samuel. Obviously, the story is not ended. This is one of those books that there's a part two. So there we got a sequel. In a lot of ways, it doesn't really feel like we're starting anything new next week. We're just continuing, right?
Yeah. I think probably, yeah, 1 and 2 Samuel, because you couldn't fit the whole thing on the one scroll.
Right.
So yeah, he's like, all right, well, we're out of scroll, so I guess we're going to move on to Samuel part two.
Yeah. And if you're going to break it up, this is as good a place as any.
I mean, it is. It's a great place to break it up. You know, Saul's out of the picture now, and we can focus on David and see what happens. We've heard plenty about him, but we got to find out the rest of his story now.
Yeah. And and make sure you tune in next week. I do think that David's response to the news is certainly noteworthy.
Yeah, we're going to see a response, and then this very powerful lament that he sings, not just over his friend Jonathan, but over Saul as well. Yeah. Very poignant lament.
Yep. All right, guys. Well, we will be in 2 Samuel next week. Hope you join us. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.